Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Sarah McDewling, and we're across from Belinda Alexandra, who is here to talk about the invitation. Thank you for taking our invitation and accepting this podcast invite.
That's all right.
There you go.
Very good.
What an intro.
It was worth coming all the way here just for that intro, John. It was really good.
Now, I was lucky enough to see a bit of presentation months ago on this book, but all the poor little listeners haven't seen that, and Sarah didn't get to see it either.
I'm just in love with the look of the book. What presentation so are you talking about?
No, because I was behind the scenes. I was, as an author behind the scenes, listening to Linda talk to the salespeople at HarperCollins about the way the book came together and the research and all that sort of stuff. So I am privileged.
Oh, so can we hear some of that now?
Yeah. One of the things I was saying is that, I'm often asked where my ideas come from or how did I get an idea for that book? And sometimes it's very difficult to know how those ideas happened. There's a giant upstairs for those that don't know what that noise was. And, John, you'll relate to this too, that your ideas don't come in a neat package quite often. So I related it to a merry-go-round because I love merry-go-rounds. I mean, if there's a fairground and there's one adult on the merry-go-round, it's usually me. And so the ideas sort of come in bits and pieces. And for me, the idea of this book, I'd worked in New York and it was a city driven by power and wealth. And this was just before the Twin Towers were attacked. And so I was really interested in the history of New York. So that sort of came up. And the Gilded Age, we're now told that we're in a new Gilded Age, where we just sort of greed is rampant. And so the Gilded Age is sort of equivalent to the Victorian Age. But in America, when they were making huge amounts of money and railway coal and steel and fortunes were being made. So that was sort of one idea. And then, of course, I think all us writers bring our stuff to our book. And one of the things that I have is I never had a sister and always wanted a sister. And then I see my friends that actually did have sisters and I would think maybe not such a good thing sometime. So I just wanted to come up with the story of two sisters very different to each other. And so that's the next sort of thing that gets on the merry-go-round as this idea is forming. And as a writer, one of the things that really fascinates me is books on psychology. I just read so many books on psychology. And I came across a book as I was, formulating my idea on psychopaths, and then apparently something like 1 in 20 people is a psychopath. And we're actually in the age of psychopaths and sociopaths. In the Victorian age, people were neurotic. They were tied to the church. They had all sorts of guilt about their bodily desires and so on. In this age, we're entitled, so we've actually gone into the age of the psychopath, people that don't have consciences and people that feel very entitled and feel that they can treat people anyway. So I thought, well, what if one of these sisters is a psychopath? And how would it be to have a sister that you dearly want to love, but she is, really quite crazy, quite manipulative to deal with? So those were sort of the ideas that blended into this story.
And that's how Caroline came to be.
Yeah, Caroline.
Interesting. Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about the story, I suppose? Because I want to ask questions about your research, but I'd rather just sort of go and give us a little bit about the story.
I'll tell you the story. The story is set in the Gilded Age. So it's set in 1899, and it's the story of two sisters, Emma and Caroline. They're born in New Orleans, but they're brought up in Paris by their grandmother. And Emma grows up to be a writer and a harpist. But the very, very ambitious and very ruthless Caroline, she marries a rich American and moves to New York. And the two sisters have very different lives. They're quite estranged until fate brings them together again when Emma is in a huge amount of debt. And Caroline makes an offer to Emma to come to New York to tutor her daughter Isadora, who's pathologically shy, to prepare her for her debut into very competitive New York society. And Emma has no idea what she has just agreed to. Across the Atlantic, Caroline lives in unbelievable wealth as one of New York's millionaires, multimillionaires. And Emma soon finds herself trapped in this glittering world, which the underbelly of is deceit, betrayal, and perhaps even murder.
So, it's such a great setup. And the age is so rich. It's just
absolutely.
So full. It's one of those ages where people come, new money comes from absolutely nowhere. And yeah. a lot of it has been made in ways that are best not talked about.
You know? Well, there was definitely rampant corruption, and the rich didn't pay tax. So the factory workers paid tax, but not the rich. And so it was really this idea, they didn't really have a social conscience. And so it was really about how to spend your money, how to really just this incredible lavish lifestyles, brush your teeth in champagne. One woman had a chandelier that she pressed a button, it released $25,000 worth of rose perfume.
Oh my
and,
God.
And you know, it was just this complete crazy decadence and outdoing each other for their decadence. And just that idea that they had no conscience, even though it was very clear there were homeless people in the street, there were children without food, the people in their factories were completely exploited because everyone was following Charles Darwin's theory of survival of the fittest, and the capitalists would use that as their excuse that, you know, it's all about competition, natural selection. And really, really a super decadent time. And people who are really shallow, like completely shallow. But don't we see that again now? Don't we see that repetition?
Do we?
Sort
do
of,
we?
I'm just trying to think
of somebody who represents that.
And that narcissism, yeah. like that complete narcissism. Yeah.
Yeah, it's difficult because the wealth and power, and in that period, with the amount of money that's going on and the amount of corruption, and that the political system was just broken at
yes.
that stage. And it feels like that now. Like,
yes.
Was that something that, like, when did you start actually thinking about that aspect of the book? Was that in the year 2016 by chance?
Or? Yes, look, it did sort of come together because what I thought was really interesting about New York was I did see patterns. And each of the historical novels that I've written about, I see patterns in those countries. Like, the Spanish seem to go through horrific episodes in their history, whether it's a civil war or whether, you know, it's the Inquisition. Russia seems to constantly be returning to dictators. And what I saw in America were these periods of absolute rampant, well, in New York particularly, rampant materialism. And when I was working in New York was like that then. It was making a lot of money. You could be a complete idiot and still become a millionaire. It was just, the streets were paved with gold. But then the Twin Towers happened and people started soul searching and thinking about things differently. And I saw this in the Gilded Age as well. You had this rampant materialism. People were very shallow. And then you had the sinking of the Titanic and the First World War, and people start to think more deeply about life. So it does make me wonder what is going to happen, like where, and this will end, this very uncomfortable train wreck that we're watching, you know, happening in America now, it will end. And so the question is when and how it will.
Well, they've had some pretty big disasters in the US lately, and that hasn't really even done it.
Like, yes.
And so,
so it's got to be something pretty spectacular.
Hopefully it's over there somewhere.
Not involved. Makes me really nervous.
Stop using history to make
yes,
good points.
Yes, but the point is that we need to learn from history. To break a pattern, you have to look at history and say, you know, even our own personal histories, if we're repeating a pattern, it's time to look at it and say, maybe you shouldn't, you know, keep dating psychopaths or something like that. I need to break this pattern.
It's a good one to break.
So, yeah, a good one to break, yeah. So if you do find yourself in that position, it's the time to reflect a little bit on what you might be doing.
When reading those books on psychology, do you think you can read those and then become over-analytical? Like, and just be watching everyone and just going, oh my God, I see the signs. Is there a fear of kind of getting too involved in that aspect? And
yeah,
especially
there's
for
a
writer.
Great line about this in the book that you have really early on, where because Emma's a writer and she says something to Claude and he says, oh, you writers are always like, You wrote the lines.
Yes, I know. You're asking me to remember what's in my own book.
It's like your writers are always, always thinking, always looking. Like, yes. Everything you see is.
Yeah,
like,
you see more into stuff that's actually there. With psychology, what I find really interesting and really about many different things in science is at the time that they're proposed, it seems like this idea is solid. Like this is the answer and this is how it is. But 100 years down the track, or even sometimes now, things are happening so rapidly, 10 years down the track, we're going, oh, that's an old idea. That's not really, you know, but people are really basing their life on those things. And what I think is really interesting about psychology that I was talking about earlier is that we used to be in the year of the neurotic. And so there are people who are still neurotic now. They're people that still have a conscience and they feel guilt and they feel shame. And so they're not coping with the psychopaths because they don't recognize them. Because things have changed now and we actually see that people don't have a conscience. And sometimes people are acting that way, not because they've been abused in childhood, not because they're feeling insecure, but just basically because they're a-holes, you know?
And the neurotics can't accept that. Do you know what I mean?
There's our quote for the podcast.
I hope that gets in. I was just thinking, how do I say this like, as blatantly as possible, but just, you know, still keep it playable for all the grandmothers out there. Actually, I should tell you that this is a little sidetrack, but you know, everyone will appreciate that. I really hate writing sex scenes in my novels because, one, I think it's kind of corny. I don't like to imagine my characters having sex any more than I like to imagine the neighbours having sex. And, but, you know, I do get, like, the nudges from the publisher and the editor, like, you know, come on, we need to see your characters, you know, you know, doing it. And now I've completely lost my train of thought about what
Well, you're talking about a-holes.
Maybe that's a bit too much detail for that. It doesn't, my sex seems a bit more tame than that, John.
Oh, goodness gracious.
There's nothing like a sex scene to get you to lose your train of thought.
Yeah, there you go. If I ever come back to it, maybe we can pop it in, whatever the point was going to be on that.
This is the one of this podcast. Is it just a free-ranging podcast?
Yes, it is.
I warned you at the beginning.
Free range, definitely free range.
So with research, one of the things that can really tie up an author is over-obsessing about a particular area and reading way too much, unnecessary reading for the needs of the novel. Do you find that a difficult thing to actually control? Because when you get into something like the Gilded Age, you start reading the history of New York and you can go detail level and then you can go detail level and get way too much. And your book becomes wobbly with heavy detail when you really want people to be moving through it.
Yeah. I think it's, for me, like my research is I go into way too much detail. I know way too much about the people of the Gilded Age. But with the story, that's right. You have to keep it as a story and you have to keep your mind on the story and it has to have a pace and the detail that you include has to move the story forward. Otherwise, really, you know, I could be there describing entire rooms, like the entire detail. I think I'm a frustrated interior designer in some ways or a frustrated costume designer because I can go into the minute details of that. But also I can go into hairstyles, beards, eye colours in great detail. But I choose just the one or two details that are really going to bring something to life. And I think that's an art when you're writing a story that you really have to, you know, get the original detail, get the detail that really helps people think, you know, they can feel that they're there, they can see it, they can see how unique this is. But yes, my research notes are copious. And the only thing that stops me from reading is a deadline. Like really, otherwise I'd still be researching white gardenia. Like, you know, I would never have stopped that, you know, we just keep going.
Well, you do it so well in here, like choosing what details to put in. I'm halfway through. You can see I'm just, this is a visual aid in a podcast, so not useful for anyone except the three of us.
We forget it, don't we? And do you like my outfit?
It's a lovely outfit.
I got my hair specially done.
For the podcast.
For people listening, this will mean more to you. I'm at page 163. I'm really, really loving it. And, like, the art of choosing what to put in there, you leave the reader wanting just a little bit more detail, but not too much. So, like, for example, early on, Emma goes on the ship to go to New York, and you describe her room, and it's the second class room in like a Titanic-esque ship. Mm. And I'm like so interested, and I want to know everything. And you just give us just enough, like these are the books that are on the shelf, and yeah. like you know, we paint the picture, and then let the story flow.
Yeah, I think it's what I love about books. I mean, I love movies as well. I'm a great film watcher as well. But what I love about books is it really is a collaboration between the writer and the reader. My characters will not be to each reader exactly as I've imagined them. They're going to bring their own experience. They're going to see their next door neighbor in this character. They're going to see their ex-boyfriend in this character. They're going to relate to the world of the book in their own individual way. And I find that really amazing that I'm really, as a writer, what we're doing, and this comes back to psychology as well, because quite often when I'm writing and I'm crying over a scene or I'm really feeling for a character, I have to step back and say, Belinda, these people aren't real. And I think, but they are. Mm. And to my readers, they're real. So we're all in this big mind mess together, which is quite exciting. And, you know, so the readers are bringing themselves to the book, so which is magic.
You consciously leave space for the reader to come in. So you, in describing somebody, you won't describe them in complete detail. So
yeah,
you know, so
just a hair color, maybe.
Yeah, just so they can fill it in.
Not always even when they first show up. Sometimes yes. it's a little bit later.
Yeah, I think you feed in the detail, but with physical detail, you do want to set up that character quite quickly because people do need the visual of the person. But then you're doing everything like in their dialogue, how they speak and the words they choose. You're showing their actions, like whether they're energetic or whether they're slow and languid. So you're actually feeding these constant details to the reader, constantly making these suggestions. But the skill is to not be heavy-handed, not to start with a huge block of detail, but that you're constantly feeding that in how the person moves, how they talk, how loudly they speak. And that's really how we feed in detail about each other as well. Mm. Like we get the visual immediately, but it's sort of, you know, like when David Beckham speaks, like, is this really sexy?
And his voice is not the voice that you're expecting, is it? So, you know,
you got to let people sort of paint the picture themselves.
Yeah.
But with details, like your description of Caroline, I remember it because it was painted such a clear vision that I think stayed with me, was that she had like slightly, that she was stylish and that had a lot of command and charm. Yeah. But like that she had slightly protuberant eyes like a pug dog. That still stuck with me.
Yeah. Like, yeah, because you can imagine a pug dog immediately.
It paints such a good picture.
And I think that's what I found really interesting about narcissists and so on, is that these are not perfect people, but they have this incredible charisma and charm that they're viewed as highly attractive. And I think that's where psychology is really interesting. Like you can see the most charming looking person, but they're shy and their shoulders are slumped. They don't have that confidence. And what I think is really interesting about narcissists, and this is a tip for all my readers here to work out how to avoid them. Are you dating a narcissist? That would be my whole other
new podcast.
New podcast that we'll go into. But now don't let me lose my train of thought. How do you know is that I think intelligent, and this is why intelligent people get sucked in by psychopaths and narcissists, is because if you're intelligent, you always have a little bit of doubt. Like you think, yeah, I'm pretty sure about this idea, or I really like this cover, but let's speak to someone else about it. You've always got, even the things you're quite certain about, you've usually got room for 5 or 10% doubt. But these people are really confidence tricksters because they have so much confidence and they speak so definitely about things. That's the right color. That's the right cover. You know, this is absolutely the way it has to be. And intelligent people get sucked in by these people. Now, we're all thinking of somebody in New York who has absolutely no self-doubt, even when people are laughing at him. And that sort of, you know, anyone else would like slink off completely humiliated, but somebody that it just has that absolute confidence. Confidence is a good thing, but also is, so is self-reflection and an element of self-doubt and a willingness to listen to other people. So if somebody doesn't have any of those qualities, it's a little red flag and just, you know,
back away.
Yeah, back away or just observe carefully. Yeah. Mm.
Jesus, good advice. I've nothing you certain people.
I
have a list.
Yeah. Well, this will be the age of paranoia that we're moving into after this podcast. Is my cat a narcissist?
I've got a good question because there are a couple of famous novels that sort of deal with this period. So Edith Wharton's Age of Innocence is one of those. But like I was just talking earlier today that in that same period, there's also Theodore Dreiser writing and Sinclair Lewis just a few years later. And they're like different worlds.
Yes.
Like Edith Wharton's world is one world and their world is nitty gritty and get down to it, kind of the industrial kind of side of things. And it reminded me of that Jane Austen and Byron were writing about the same period and that their views were so different.
The perspective is so different.
Yeah.
There's also a really cool little allusion to Dracula in here, which I liked.
Yeah. Yeah, because Emma is writes Gothic literature, there is quite a few of references to her. And, you know, even it was really, it's the first time because I've had my characters have different professions and I've really enjoyed exploring those, but I've never had a writer in my book before. And I thought it was 8 books now and I think it's time for a character that's a writer. So that was really interesting, having one of the main characters.
What were the editors and publishers like when they read the views of the writer?
Oh, well, I think her views are more about things from not so much her view of her, publisher is quite positive, of course.
He knew someone was going to be reading it.
She's dealing in a world where people are like, oh, she's an authoress.
Yes.
Tacky.
Yes, when people did see writing as sort of equivalent to being a music hall dancer and...
Prostitute.
Yeah, or prostitute. Yeah, basically she's seen as a bit déclassé and, you know, that. And... now I'm going to stay on my train of
thought. In Portugal, is it Portugal?
Oh, hang on. No. I've got it's come back. It's come back. Stay focused.
Really working against you on this.
Yeah, I know. But that's okay. No, it's actually me. It's just I'm so charmed by the both of you. I can't stay on track. But one of the things that Emma says is I don't like to write in first person because what happens when I write in first person is this stuff starts happening to me. It's almost like manifesting her life. And so there is a part towards when you get to the end of the book, you'll see that she manifests something quite gruesome.
Oh, my God.
Purposely writing in first person to bring it about in the middle of the night. So there is all that sort of gothic sort of reference in there as well. And I think actually if you asked me to describe the style of the book, I think it's a little bit domestic noir because there's this feeling of not being safe in your domestic situation.
Right early on.
Yeah.
Like you've just got a bad feeling about this sister.
Yeah.
And like the way that people are like, oh, she's your sister. Oh.
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk to you anymore. Bye.
But she's sort of been feeding, like, you know, she's, you know, bringing in Emma slowly from childhood. So Emma doesn't really notice these things until she really literally ends up trapped by her sister. Yeah. It gets scarier and it speeds up towards the end. So almost a little thriller element in there as well.
One last question, which is a, kind of a minor point, but why is the, like, all of your books have had one kind of title?
New cover.
New cover look, but the invitation is a different kind of title.
Everything
is different. I think it's a new direction for me in so many ways. It's really getting away from the historical saga and the generational story, and it's much more intense story. It takes place over 1 year, and it's really the intense story between two sisters and one completely manipulating the other. So it sort of creates a more contained, more claustrophobic kind of atmosphere. And the invitation, it just, the title just went with that. It's more, an invitation can be a good thing or an invitation can be a bad thing, depending on what you get sucked into, really. And so that's the sort of idea that she's beckoned into this world that is actually quite dangerous for her.
Oh, that leads me to a whole lot of other questions, but we haven't got time for more questions.
Yeah, we all have the train of thought. So early dementia.
Yeah, because it strikes me that it's interesting that you've changed, or this story was so overpowering that you've sort of gone in one completely new direction.
Yes.
Was that something that just you had no control over? It was just like my imagination went there and I had to go with it?
Yeah, I think it was just evolving. Mm-hmm. And this story is actually a linear story, whereas the last three stories I've written have gone from past to present. Mm-hmm. And it was just really time to get back to a strong, contained story. And there were only so many mysterious grandmothers with secret histories that I could go through. And so this is, really much more about the two sisters and an intense relationship. Yeah.
Linda, thank you so much for coming in. It was always a joy having you here.
It's always a joy.
We have to wait 2 years every time.
I know. I'm slow.
It's worth the wait.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can get hold of all of Linda's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.